all in splendid style, for 11 rubles and a half. The first morning I came back from the office, I found Katerina Ivanovna had cooked 2 courses for dinner, soup and salt meat with horseradish, which we had never dreamed of till then. She had not any dresses, none at all, but she dressed up as though she were going on a visit. And not that she'd anything to do it with. She smartened herself up with nothing at all. She'd done her hair nicely, put on a clean collar of some sort, cuffs, and there she was. Quite a different person. She was younger and better looking. "Sonya, my little darling, had only helped with money for the time," she said. "It won't do for me to come and see you too often. After dark, maybe, when no one can see. Do you hear? Do you hear?" I lay down for a nap after dinner. And what do you think? Though Katerina Ivanovna had quarrelled to the last degree with our landlady, Amalia Fyodorovna, only a week before, she could not resist then asking her into coffee. For 2 hours they were sitting, whispering together. "Semyon Sakharovich is in the service again now, and receiving a salary," says she. "And he went himself to His Excellency, and His Excellency himself came out to him, made all the others wait, and led Semyon Zakharovich by the hand before everybody into his study. Do you hear? Do you hear?" "To be sure," says he, "Semyon Zakharovich, remembering your past services," says he, "and in spite of your propensity to that foolish weakness, since you promise now, and since, moreover, we've got on badly without you, do you hear, do you hear? And so," says he, "I rely now on your word as a gentleman." And all that, let me tell you, she has simply made up for herself, and not simply out of wantonness, for the sake of bragging, no. She believes it all herself. She amuses herself with her own fancies, upon my word she does. And I don't blame her for it, no, I don't blame her. 6 days ago, when I brought her my first earnings in full, 23 rubles 40 kopecks altogether, she called me her puppet. 'Puppet,' said she, 'my little puppet.' And when we were by ourselves, you understand? You would not think me a beauty. You would not think much of me as a husband, would you? Well, she pinched my cheek. 'My little puppet,' said she." Marmeladov broke off, tried to smile, but suddenly his chin began to twitch. He controlled himself, however. The tavern, the degraded appearance of the man, the 5 nights in the hay barge, and the pot of spirits, and yet this poignant love for his wife and children bewildered his listener. Raskolnikov listened intently, but with a sick sensation. He felt vexed that he had come here. "Honored sir, honored sir," cried Marmeladov, recovering himself. "Oh, sir, perhaps all this seems a laughing matter to you, as it does to others, and perhaps I am only worrying you with the stupidity of all the trivial details of my home life. But it is not a laughing matter to me, for I can feel it all, and the whole of that heavenly day of my life, and the whole of that evening I passed in fleeting dreams of how I would arrange it all, and how I would dress all the children, and how I should give her rest, and how I should rescue my own daughter from dishonor and restore her to the bosom of her family, and a great deal more. Quite excusable, sir. Well, then, sir—" Marmeladov suddenly gave a sort of start, raised his head, and gazed intently at his listener. "Well, and the very next day after all those dreams. That is to say, exactly 5 days ago, in the evening, by a cunning trick like a thief in the night, I stole from Katerina Ivanovna the key of her box, took out what was left of my earnings, how much it was I have forgotten, and now look at me, all of you. It's the fifth day since I left home, and they are looking for me there, and it's the end of my employment. And my uniform is lying in a tavern on the Egyptian bridge. I exchanged it for the garments I have on. And it's the end of everything. Marmeladov struck his forehead with his fist, clenched his teeth, closed his eyes, and leaned heavily with his elbow on the table. But a minute later, his face suddenly changed, and with a certain assumed slyness and affectation of bravado, he glanced at Raskolnikov, laughed, and said, "This morning I went to see Sonya. I went to ask her for a pick-me-up. You don't say she gave it to you?" cried one of the newcomers. He shouted the words and went off into a guffaw.
"This very quart was bought with her money," Marmeladov declared, addressing himself exclusively to Raskolnikov. 30 kopecks she gave me with her own hands, her last, all she had, as I saw. She said nothing. She only looked at me without a word. Not on earth, but up yonder, they grieve over men, they weep, but they don't blame them. They don't blame them. But it hurts more. It hurts more when they don't blame. 30 kopecks, yes. And maybe she needs them now, eh? What do you think, my dear sir? For now she's got to keep up her appearance. It costs money, that smartness, that special smartness, you know. Do you understand? And there's hair pomade, too, you see. She must have things, petticoats, starched ones, shoes, too, real jaunty ones to show off her foot when she has to step over a puddle. Do you understand, sir? Do you understand what all that smartness means? And here I, her own father. Here I took 30 kopecks of that money for a drink. And I am drinking it. And I have already drunk it. Come, who will have pity on a man like me, eh? Are you sorry for me, sir, or not? Tell me, sir. Are you sorry or not? He would have filled his glass, but there was no drink left. The pot was empty.
"What are you to be pitied for?" shouted the tavern keeper, who was again near them. Shouts of laughter and even oaths followed. The laughter and the oaths came from those who were listening, and also from those who had heard nothing but were simply looking at the figure of the discharged government clerk.
"To be pitied! Why am I to be pitied?" Marmeladov suddenly declaimed, standing up with his arm outstretched, as though he had been only waiting for that question. "Why am I to be pitied, you say? Yes. There's nothing to pity me for. I ought to be crucified. Crucified on a cross, not pitied. Crucify me, O judge, crucify me, but pity me. And then I will go of myself to be crucified, for it's not merrymaking I seek, but tears and tribulation. Do you suppose, you, that sell, that this pint of yours has been sweet to me? It was tribulation I sought at the bottom of it. Tears and tribulation, and have found it, and I have tasted it. But he will pity us, who has had pity on all men, who has understood all men and all things. He is the one. He, too, is the judge. He will come in that day, and he will ask, where is the daughter who gave herself for her cross, consumptive stepmother, and for the little children of another? Where is the daughter who had pity upon the filthy drunkard, her earthly father, undismayed by his beastliness? And he will say, come to me. I have already forgiven thee once. I have forgiven thee once. Thy sins, which are many, are forgiven thee, for thou hast loved much. And he will forgive, my Sonia. He will forgive, I know it. I felt it in my heart when I was with her just now. And he will judge and will forgive all, the good and the evil, the wise and the meek. And when he has done with all of them, then he will summon us. You too, come forth, he will say. Come forth, ye drunkards. Come forth, ye weak ones. Come forth, ye children of shame. And we shall all come forth without shame, and shall stand before him, and he will say unto us, ye are swine, made in the image of the beast, and with his mark. But come ye also. And the wise ones, and those of understanding, will say, O Lord, why dost thou receive these men? And he will say, this is why I receive them, O ye wise. This is why I receive them, O ye of understanding, that not one of them believed himself to be worthy of this. And he will hold out his hands to us, and we shall fall down before him, and we shall weep, and we shall understand all things. Then we shall understand all. And all will understand, Katerina Ivanovna even, she will understand, Lord, thy kingdom come. And he sank down on the bench exhausted and helpless, looking at no one, apparently oblivious of his surroundings, and plunged in deep thought. His words had created a certain impression. There was a moment of silence. But soon, laughter and oaths were heard again.
That's his notion. Talked himself silly.
A fine clerk he is. And so on, and so on.
Let us go, sir,
said Marmeladov all at once, raising his head and addressing Raskolnikov.
Come along with me. Kozel's house, looking into the yard. I'm going to Katerina Ivanovna. Time I did.
Raskolnikov had for some time been wanting to go, and he had meant to help him. Marmeladov was much unsteadier on his legs than in his speech, and leaned heavily on the young man. They had 200 or 300 paces to go. The drunken man was more and more overcome by dismay and confusion as they drew nearer the house.
It's not Katerina Ivanovna I am afraid of now, he muttered in agitation. And that she will begin pulling my hair. What does my hair matter? Forget my hair, that's what I say. Indeed, it will be better if she does begin pulling it. That's not what I am afraid of. It's her eyes I am afraid of. Yes, her eyes. The red on her cheeks, too, frightens me. And her breathing, too. Have you noticed how people in that disease breathe when they are excited? I am frightened of the children's crying, too. For if Sonia has not taken them food, I don't know what's happened, I don't know. But blows I am not afraid of. No, sir, that such blows are not a pain to me, but even an enjoyment. In fact,
I can't get on without it. It's better so. Let her strike me. It relieves her heart. It's better so. There is the house. The house of Cozero, the cabinet maker. A German, well-to-do. Lead the way.
They went in from the yard and up to the fourth story. The staircase got darker and darker as they went up. It was nearly 11 o'clock, and although in summer in Petersburg there is no real night, yet it was quite dark at the top of the stairs. A grimy little door at the very top of the stairs stood ajar. A very poor-looking room, about 10 paces long, was lighted up by a candle-end. The whole of it was visible from the entrance. It was all in disorder, littered up with rags of all sorts, especially children's garments. Across the furthest corner was stretched a ragged sheet. Behind it probably was the bed. There was nothing in the room except 2 chairs and a sofa, covered with American leather, full of holes, before which stood an old deal kitchen table, unpainted and uncovered. At the edge of the table stood a smouldering tallow candle in an iron candlestick. It appeared that the family had a room to themselves, not part of a room, but their room was practically a passage. The door leading to the other rooms, or rather cupboards, into which Amalia Lippevechsel's flat was divided, stood half open, and there was shouting, uproar, and laughter within. People seemed to be playing cards and drinking tea there. Words of the most unceremonious kind flew out from time to time. Raskolnikov recognized Katerina Ivanovna at once. She was a rather tall, slim and graceful woman, terribly emaciated, with magnificent dark brown hair, and with a hectic flush in her cheeks. She was pacing up and down in her little room, pressing her hands against her chest. Her lips were parched, and her breathing came in nervous, broken gasps. Her eyes glittered as in fever, and looked about with a harsh, immovable stare. And that consumptive and excited face, with the last flickering light of the candle-end playing upon it, made a sickening impression. She seemed to Raskolnikov about 30 years old, and was certainly a strange wife for Marmeladov. She hadn't heard them, and didn't notice them coming in. She seemed to be lost in thought, hearing and seeing nothing. The room was close, but she had not opened the window. A stench rose from the staircase, but the door on to the stairs was not closed. From the inner rooms, clouds of tobacco smoke floated in. She kept coughing, but didn't close the door. The youngest child, a girl of 6, was asleep, sitting curled up on the floor with her head on the sofa. A boy, a year older, stood crying and shaking in the corner. Probably he had just had a beating. Beside him stood a girl of 9 years old, tall and thin, wearing a thin and ragged chemise with an ancient cashmere pelisse flung over her bare shoulders, long outgrown and barely reaching her knees. Her arm, as thin as a stick, was round her brother's neck. She was trying to comfort him, whispering something to him, and doing all she could to keep him from whimpering again. At the same time, her large dark eyes, which looked larger still from the thinness of her frightened face, were watching her mother with alarm. Marmeladov did not enter the door, but dropped on his knees in the very doorway, pushing Raskolnikov in front of him. The woman, seeing a stranger, stopped indifferently facing him, coming to herself for a moment and apparently wondering what he had come for. But evidently she decided that he was going into the next room, as he had to pass through hers to get there. Taking no further notice of him, she walked towards the outer door to close it, and uttered a sudden scream on seeing her husband on his knees in the doorway. "Ah!" she cried out in a frenzy. "He has come back! The criminal! The monster! And where is the money? What's in your pocket? Show me! And your clothes are all different. Where are your clothes? Where is the money? Speak!" And she fell to searching him. Marmeladov submissively and obediently held up both arms to facilitate the search. Not a farthing was there.
"Where's the money?" she cried. "Mercy on us! Can he have drunk it all? There were 12 silver rubles left in the chest."
And in a fury, she seized him by the hair and dragged him into the room. Marmeladov seconded her efforts by meekly crawling along on his knees.
"And this is a consolation to me. This does not hurt me, but is a positive consolation. Honored sir," he called out, shaken to and fro by his hair,
and even once striking the ground with his forehead. The child asleep on the floor woke up and began to cry. The boy in the corner, losing all control, began trembling and screaming, and rushed to his sister in violent terror, almost in a fit. The eldest girl was shaking like a leaf.
"He's drunk it! He's drunk it all!" the poor woman screamed in despair. "And his clothes are gone, and they are hungry, hungry!"
And wringing her hands, she pointed to the children.
"Oh, accursed life, and you, are you not ashamed?"
She pounced all at once upon Raskolnikov.
"From the tavern. Have you been drinking with him? You have been drinking with him, too. Go away."
The young man was hastening away without uttering a word. The inner door was thrown wide open, and inquisitive faces were peering in at it. Coarse, laughing faces with pipes and cigarettes, and heads wearing caps thrust themselves in at the doorway. Further in could be seen figures in dressing gowns flung open, in costumes of unseemly scantiness, some of them with cards in their hands. They were particularly diverted when Marmeladov, dragged about by his hair, shouted that it was a consolation to him. They even began to come into the room. At last, a sinister, shrill outcry was heard. This came from Amalia Lippevechsel herself, pushing her way amongst them and trying to restore order after her own fashion, and for the 100th time to frighten the poor woman by ordering her with coarse abuse to clear out of the room next day. As he went out, Raskolnikov had time to put his hand into his pocket, to snatch up the coppers he had received in exchange for his ruble in the tavern, and to lay them unnoticed on the window. Afterwards, on the stairs, he changed his mind and would have gone back. "What a stupid thing I've done," he thought to himself. "They have Sonya, and I want it myself." But reflecting that it would be impossible to take it back now, and that in any case he would not have taken it, he dismissed it with a wave of his hand and went back to his lodging. "Sonya wants hair pomade, too," he said as he walked along the street, and he laughed malignantly. "Such smartness costs money. And maybe Sonya herself will be bankrupt today, for there is always a risk hunting big game, digging for gold. Then they would all be without a crust tomorrow, except for my money. Hurrah for Sonya! What a mine they've dug there! And they're making the most of it. Yes, they are making the most of it. They've wept over it and grown used to it." Man grows used to everything. The scoundrel. He sank into thought. "And what if I am wrong?" he cried suddenly after a moment's thought. "What if man is not really a scoundrel? Man in general, I mean. The whole race of mankind. Then all the rest is prejudice. Simply artificial terrors. And there are no barriers. And it's all as it should be." Chapter 3. He waked up late next day, after a broken sleep. But his sleep had not refreshed him. He waked up bilious, irritable, ill-tempered, and looked with hatred at his room. It was a tiny cupboard of a room about 6 paces in length. It had a poverty-stricken appearance with its dusty yellow paper peeling off the walls. And it was so low-pitched that a man of more than average height was ill at ease in it, and felt every moment that he would knock his head against the ceiling. The furniture was in keeping with the room. There were 3 old chairs, rather rickety, a painted table in the corner on which lay a few manuscripts and books. The dust that lay thick upon them showed that they had been long untouched. A big clumsy sofa occupied almost the whole of one wall and half the floor space of the room. It was once covered with chintz but was now in rags, and served Raskolnikov as a bed. Often he went to sleep on it, as he was, without undressing, without sheets, wrapped in his old student's overcoat, with his head on one little pillow, under which he heaped up all the linen he had, clean and dirty, by way of a bolster. A little table stood in front of the sofa. It would have been difficult to sink to a lower ebb of disorder. But to Raskolnikov, in his present state of mind, this was positively agreeable. He had got completely away from everyone, like a tortoise in its shell. And even the sight of the servant girl, who had to wait upon him and looked sometimes into his room, made him writhe with nervous irritation. He was in the condition that overtakes some monomaniacs entirely concentrated upon one thing. His landlady had for the last fortnight given up sending him in meals, and he had not yet thought of expostulating with her, though he went without his dinner. Nastasya, the cook and only servant, was rather pleased at the lodger's mood, and had entirely given up sweeping and doing his room. Only once a week or so she would stray into his room with a broom. She waked him up that day. "Get up! Why are you asleep?" she called to him. "It's past 9. I have brought you some tea. Will you have a cup? I should think you're fairly starving." Raskolnikov opened his eyes, started, and recognized Nastasya. "From the landlady, eh?" he asked, slowly and with a sickly face, sitting up on the sofa. "From the landlady, indeed." She set before him her own cracked teapot full of weak and stale tea, and laid 2 yellow lumps of sugar by the side of it. "Here, Nastasya, take it, please," he said, fumbling in his pocket, for he had slept in his clothes, and taking out a handful of coppers. "Run and buy me a loaf. And get me a little sausage, the cheapest at the pork butcher's."
"The loaf I'll fetch you this very minute, but wouldn't you rather have some cabbage soup instead of sausage? It's capital soup, yesterday's. I saved it for you yesterday, but you came in late. It's fine soup."
When the soup had been brought, and he had begun upon it, Nastasya sat down beside him on the sofa and began chatting. She was a country peasant woman, and a very talkative one.
"Praskovya Pavlovna means to complain to the police about you," she said.
He scowled. "To the police? What does she want?"
"You don't pay her money, and you won't turn out of the room. That's what she wants, to be sure."
"The devil, that's the last straw," he muttered, grinding his teeth. "No, that would not suit me. Just now. She is a fool," he added aloud. "I'll go and talk to her today."
"Fool she is, and no mistake, just as I am. But why, if you are so clever, do you lie here like a sack and have nothing to show for it? One time you used to go out, you say, to teach children. But why is it you do nothing now?"
"I am doing..." Raskolnikov began sullenly and reluctantly.
"What are you doing?"
"Work."
"What sort of work?"
"I am thinking," he answered seriously after a pause. Nastasya was overcome with a fit of laughter. She was given to laughter, and when anything amused her, she laughed inaudibly, quivering and shaking all over till she felt ill.
"'And have you made much money by your thinking?' she managed to articulate at last.
"'One can't go out to give lessons without boots. "'And I'm sick of it.
"'Don't quarrel with your bread and butter.
"'They pay so little for lessons. "'What's the use of a few coppers?' he answered, "'reluctantly, as though replying to his own thought.
"'And you want to get a fortune all at once?'
"'He looked at her strangely.
"'Yes. "'I want a fortune,'
he answered firmly, after a brief pause.
"'Don't be in such a hurry. "'You quite frighten me. "'Shall I get you the loaf or not?'
"'As you please.
"'Ah, I forgot. "'A letter came for you yesterday when you were out.
"'A letter? For me? From whom?'
"'I can't say. "'I gave 3 kopecks of my own to the postman for it. "'Will you pay me back?'
"'Then bring it to me, for God's sake, bring it!' cried Raskolnikov, greatly excited.
"'Good God!'
A minute later the letter was brought him. That was it, from his mother, from the province of R. He turned pale when he took it. It was a long while since he had received a letter. But another feeling also suddenly stabbed his heart. "'Nastasya, leave me alone, for goodness sake. Here are your 3 kopecks, but for goodness sake, make haste and go!' The letter was quivering in his hand. He didn't want to open it in her presence. He wanted to be left alone with this letter. When Nastasya had gone out, he lifted it quickly to his lips and kissed it. Then he gazed intently at the address, the small, sloping handwriting, so dear and familiar, of the mother who had once taught him to read and write. He delayed. He seemed almost afraid of something. At last he opened it. It was a thick, heavy letter, weighing over 2 ounces. 2 large sheets of notepaper were covered with very small handwriting. "My dear Rodya," wrote his mother, "it's 2 months since I last had a talk with you by letter, which has distressed me, and even kept me awake at night, thinking. But I am sure you will not blame me for my inevitable silence. You know how I love you. You are all we have to look to, Dunya and I. You are our all, our one hope, our one stay. What a grief it was to me when I heard that you had given up the university some months ago for want of means to keep yourself, and that you had lost your lessons and your other work. How could I help you out of my 120 rubles a year pension? The 15 rubles I sent you 4 months ago I borrowed, as you know, on security of my pension from Vasily Ivanovich Vakhrushin, a merchant of this town. He is a kind-hearted man, and was a friend of your father's, too. But having given him the right to receive the pension, I had to wait till the debt was paid off, and that is only just done so that I've been unable to send you anything all this time. But now, thank God, I believe I shall be able to send you something more, and in fact we may congratulate ourselves on our good fortune now, of which I hasten to inform you. In the first place, would you have guessed, dear Rodya, that your sister has been living with me for the last 6 weeks, and we shall not be separated in the future? Thank God her sufferings are over, but I will tell you everything in order so that you may know just how everything has happened, and all that we have hitherto concealed from you. When you wrote to me 2 months ago that you had heard that Dunya had a great deal to put up with in the Svidrigailov's house, when you wrote that and asked me to tell you all about it, what could I write in answer to you? If I had written the whole truth to you, I dare say you would have thrown up everything and have come to us, even if you had to walk all the way, for I know your character and your feelings, and you would not let your sister be insulted. I was in despair myself, but what could I do? And besides, I did not know the whole truth myself then. What made it all so difficult
was that Dunya received 100 rubles in advance when she took the place as governess in their family, on condition of part of her salary being deducted every month. And so it was impossible to throw up the situation without repaying the debt. This sum, now I can explain it all to you, my precious Rodya, she took chiefly in order to send you 60 rubles which you needed so terribly then, and which you received from us last year. We deceived you then, writing that this money came from Dunya's savings. But that was not so. And now I tell you all about it, because, thank God, things have suddenly changed for the better, and that you may know how Dunya loves you and what a heart she has. At first, indeed, Mr. Svidrigailov treated her very rudely, and used to make disrespectful and jeering remarks at table. But I don't want to go into all those painful details, so as not to worry you for nothing when it is now all over. In short, in spite of the kind and generous behavior of Marfa Petrovna, Mr. Svidrigailov's wife, and all the rest of the household, Dunya had a very hard time, especially when Mr. Svidrigailov, relapsing into his old regimental habits, was under the influence of Bacchus. And how do you think it was all explained later on? Would you believe that the crazy fellow had conceived a passion for Dunya from the beginning, but had concealed it under a show of rudeness and contempt? Possibly he was ashamed and horrified himself at his own flighty hopes, considering his years and his being the father of a family. And that made him angry with Dunya. And possibly, too, he hoped by his rude and sneering behavior to hide the truth from others. But at last he lost all control, and had the face to make Dunya an open and shameful proposal, promising her all sorts of inducements and offering, besides, to throw up everything and take her to another estate of his, or even abroad. You can imagine all she went through. To leave her situation at once was impossible, not only on account of the money debt, but also to spare the feelings of Marfa Petrovna, whose suspicions would have been aroused. And then Dunya would have been the cause of a rupture in the family. And it would have meant a terrible scandal for Dunya, too, that would have been inevitable. There were various other reasons owing to which Dunya could not hope to escape from that awful house for another 6 weeks. You know Dunya, of course. You know how clever she is, and what a strong will she has. Dunya can endure a great deal, and even in the most difficult cases, she has the fortitude to maintain her firmness. She did not even write to me about everything for fear of upsetting me, although we were constantly in communication. It all ended very unexpectedly. Marfa Petrovna accidentally overheard her husband imploring Dunya in the garden, and, putting quite a wrong interpretation on the position, threw the blame upon her, believing her to be the cause of it all. An awful scene took place between them on the spot, in the garden. Marfa Petrovna went so far as to strike Dunya, refused to hear anything, and was shouting at her for a whole hour, and then gave orders that Dunya should be packed off at once to me in a plain peasant's cart, into which they flung all her things, her linen and her clothes, all pell-mell, without folding it up and packing it. And a heavy shower of rain came on, too, and Dunya, insulted and put to shame, had to drive with a peasant in an open cart all the 17 versts into town. Only think now, what answer could I have sent to the letter I received from you 2 months ago, and what could I have written? I was in despair. I dared not write to you the truth, because you would have been very unhappy, mortified, and indignant. And yet what could you do? You could only, perhaps, ruin yourself. And besides, Dunya would not allow it. And fill up my letter with trifles when my heart was so full of sorrow, I could not. For a whole month, the town was full of gossip about this scandal. And it came to such a pass that Dunya and I dared not even go to church, on account of the contemptuous looks, whispers, and even remarks made aloud about us. All our acquaintances avoided us. Nobody even bowed to us in the street. And I learned that some shopmen and clerks were intending to insult us in a shameful way, smearing the gates of our house with pitch, so that the landlord began to tell us we must leave. All this was set going by Marfa Petrovna, who managed to slander Dunya and throw dirt at her in every family. She knows everyone in the neighborhood. And that month she was continually coming into the town. And as she is rather talkative and fond of gossiping about her family affairs, and particularly of complaining to all and each of her husband, which is not at all right, so in a short time she had spread her story not only in the town, but over the whole surrounding district. It made me ill. But Dunya bore it better than I did. And if only you could have seen how she endured it all and tried to comfort me and cheer me up. She is an angel. But, by God's mercy, our sufferings were cut short. Mr. Svidrigaïlov returned to his senses and repented, and, probably feeling sorry for Dunya, he laid before Marfa Petrovna a complete and unmistakable proof of Dunya's innocence, in the form of a letter Dunya had been forced to write and give to him before Marfa Petrovna came upon them in the garden. This letter, which remained in Mr. Svidrigaïlov's hands after her departure, she had written to refuse personal explanations and secret interviews, for which he was entreating her. In that letter, she reproached him with great heat and indignation for the baseness of his behavior in regard to Marfa Petrovna, reminding him that he was the father and head of a family, and telling him how infamous it was of him to torment and make unhappy a defenseless girl. Unhappy enough already. Indeed, dear Rodya, the letter was so nobly and touchingly written that I sobbed when I read it, and to this day I cannot read it without tears. Moreover, the evidence of the servants, too, cleared Dunya's reputation. They had seen and known a great deal more than Mr. Svidrigaïlov had himself supposed, as indeed is always the case with servants. Marfa Petrovna was completely taken aback, and again crushed, as she said herself to us. But she was completely convinced of Dunya's innocence. The very next day, being Sunday, she went straight to the cathedral, knelt down, and prayed with tears to Our Lady to give her strength to bear this new trial and to do her duty. Then she came straight from the cathedral to us, told us the whole story, wept bitterly, and fully penitent, she embraced Dunya and besought her to forgive her. The same morning, without any delay, she went round to all the houses in the town, and everywhere, shedding tears, she asserted in the most flattering terms Dunya's innocence, and the nobility of her feelings and her behavior. What was more, she showed and read to everyone the letter in Dunya's own handwriting to Mr. Svidrigaïlov, and even allowed them to take copies of it, which I must say I think was superfluous. In this way she was busy for several days in driving about the whole town, because some people had taken offense through precedence having been given to others. And therefore they had to take turns, so that in every house she was expected before she arrived, and everyone knew that on such and such a day Marfa Petrovna would be reading the letter in such and such a place, and people assembled for every reading of it. Even many who had heard it several times already, both in their own houses and in other people's. In my opinion, a great deal, a very great deal, of all this was unnecessary. But that's Marfa Petrovna's character. Anyway, she succeeded in completely re-establishing Dunya's reputation, and the whole ignominy of this affair rested as an indelible disgrace upon her husband, as the only person to blame. So that I really began to feel sorry for him. It was really treating the crazy fellow too harshly. Dunya was at once asked to give lessons in several families, but she refused. All of a sudden everyone began to treat her with marked respect, and all this did much to bring about the event by which, one may say, our whole fortunes are now transformed. You must know, dear Rodya, that Dunya has a suitor, and that she has already consented to marry him. I hasten to tell you all about the matter, and though it has been arranged without asking your consent, I think you will not be aggrieved with me or with your sister on that account, for you will see that we could not wait and put off our decision till we heard from you. And you could not have judged all the facts without being on the spot. This was how it happened. He is already of the rank of a counselor, Pyotr Petrovich Luzhin, and is distantly related to Marfa Petrovna, who has been very active in bringing the match about. It began with his expressing through her his desire to make our acquaintance. He was properly received, drank coffee with us, and the very next day he sent us a letter in which he very courteously made an offer and begged for a speedy and decided answer. He is a very busy man and is in a great hurry to get to Petersburg, so that every moment is precious to him. At first, of course, we were greatly surprised, as it had all happened so quickly and unexpectedly. We thought and talked it over the whole day. He is a well-to-do man, to be depended upon. He has two posts in the government, and has already made his fortune. It is true that he is 45 years old, but he is of a fairly prepossessing appearance and might still be thought attractive by women, and he is altogether a very respectable and presentable man, only he seems a little morose and somewhat conceited. But possibly that may only be the impression he makes at first sight. And beware, dear Rodya, when he comes to Petersburg, as he shortly will do, beware of judging him too hastily and severely, as your way is, if there is anything you do not like in him at first sight. I give you this warning, although I feel sure that he will make a favorable impression upon you. Moreover, in order to understand any man, one must be deliberate and careful to avoid forming prejudices and mistaken ideas, which are very difficult to correct and get over afterwards. And Pyotr Petrovich, judging by many indications, is a thoroughly estimable man. At his first visit, indeed, he told us that he was a practical man, but still he shares, as he expressed it, many of the convictions of our most rising generation, and he is an opponent of all prejudices. He said a good deal more, for he seems a little conceited and likes to be listened to, but this is scarcely a vice. I, of course, understood very little of it, but Dunya explained to me that, though he is not a man of great education, he is clever and seems to be good-natured. You know your sister's character, Rodya. She is a resolute, sensible, patient, and generous girl, but she has a passionate heart, as I know very well. Of course, there is no great love either on his side or on hers, but Dunya is a clever girl and has the heart of an angel, and will make it her duty to make her husband happy, who, on his side, will make her happiness his care. Of that we have no good reason to doubt, though it must be admitted the matter has been arranged in great haste. Besides, he is a man of great prudence, and he will see, to be sure of himself, that his own happiness will be the more secure, the happier Dunya is with him. And as for some defects of character, for some habits and even certain differences of opinion, which indeed are inevitable even in the happiest marriages, Dunya has said that, as regards all that, she relies on herself, that there is nothing to be uneasy about, and that she is ready to put up with a great deal if only their future relationship can be an honorable and straightforward one. He struck me, for instance, at first, as rather abrupt, but that may well come from his being an outspoken man, and that is no doubt how it is. For instance, at his second visit, after he had received Dunya's consent, in the course of conversation he declared that before making Dunya's acquaintance, he had made up his mind to marry a girl of good reputation, without dowry and, above all, one who had experienced poverty. Because, as he explained, a man ought not to be indebted to his wife, but that it is better for a wife to look upon her husband as her benefactor. I must add that he expressed it more nicely and politely than I have done, for I have forgotten his actual phrases and only remember the meaning. And besides, it was obviously not said of design, but slipped out in the heat of conversation. so that he tried afterwards to correct himself and smooth it over, but all the same, it did strike me as somewhat rude, and I said so afterwards to Dunya. But Dunya was vexed, and answered that words are not deeds, and that, of course, is perfectly true. Dunya did not sleep all night before she made up her mind, and thinking that I was asleep, she got out of bed and was walking up and down the room all night. At last she knelt down before the icon, and prayed long and fervently, and in the morning she told me that she had decided. I have mentioned already that Pyotr Petrovitch is just setting off for Petersburg, where he has a great deal of business, and he wants to open a legal office. He has been occupied for many years in conducting civil and commercial litigation, and only the other day he won an important case. He has to be in Petersburg because he has an important case before the Senate. So, Roger, dear, he may be of the greatest use to you, in every way indeed. And Dunya and I have agreed that from this very day you could definitely enter upon your career and might consider that your future is marked out and assured for you. Oh, if only this comes to pass! This would be such a benefit that we could only look upon it as a providential blessing. Dunya is dreaming of nothing else. We have even ventured already to drop a few words on the subject to Pyotr Petrovitch. He was cautious in his answer and said that, of course, as he could not get on without a secretary, it would be better to be paying a salary to a relation than to a stranger, if only the former were fitted for the duties, as though there could be doubt of your being fitted. But then he expressed doubts whether your studies at the university would leave you time for work at his office. The matter dropped for the time, but Dunya is thinking of nothing else now. She has been in a sort of fever for the last few days, and has already made a regular plan for your becoming, in the end, an associate and even a partner in Pyotr Petrovich's business, which might well be, seeing that you are a student of law. I am in complete agreement with her, Rodya, and share all her plans and hopes, and think there is every probability of realizing them. And in spite of Pyotr Petrovich's evasiveness, very natural at present, since he does not know you, Dunya is firmly persuaded that she will gain everything by her good influence over her future husband. This she is reckoning upon. Of course, we are careful not to talk of any of these more remote plans to Pyotr Petrovitch, especially of your becoming his partner. He is a practical man and might take this very coldly. It might all seem to him simply a daydream. Nor has either Dunya or I breathed a word to him of the great hopes we have of his helping us to pay for your university studies. We have not spoken of it in the first place, because it will come to pass of itself later on, and he will no doubt, without wasting words, offer to do it of himself, as though he could refuse Dunya that. The more readily, since you may, by your own efforts, become his right hand in the office, and receive this assistance not as a charity, but as a salary earned by your own work. Dunya wants to arrange it all like this, and I quite agree with her. And we have not spoken of our plans for another reason, that is, because I particularly wanted you to feel on an equal footing when you first meet him. When Dunya spoke to him with enthusiasm about you, he answered that one could never judge of a man without seeing him close, for oneself, and that he looked forward to forming his own opinion when he makes your acquaintance. Do you know, my precious Rodya, I think that perhaps for some reasons, nothing to do with Pyotr Petrovitch, though simply for my own personal, perhaps old womanish fancies, I should do better to go on living by myself, apart, than with them after the wedding. I am convinced that he will be generous and delicate enough to invite me and to urge me to remain with my daughter for the future, and if he has said nothing about it hitherto, it is simply because it has been taken for granted. But I shall refuse. I have noticed more than once in my life that husbands don't quite get on with their mothers-in-law, and I don't want to be the least bit in anyone's way, and for my own sake, too, would rather be quite independent so long as I have a crust of bread of my own, and such children as you and Dunya. If possible, I would settle somewhere near you. For the most joyful piece of news, dear Rodya, I have kept for the end of my letter. Know then, my dear boy, that we may, perhaps, be all together in a very short time, and may embrace one another again after a separation of almost 3 years. It is settled for certain that Dunya and I are to set off for Petersburg, exactly when, I don't know, but very, very soon, possibly in a week. It all depends on Pyotr Petrovich, who will let us know when he has had time to look round him in Petersburg. To suit his own arrangements, he is anxious to have the ceremony as soon as possible, even before the fast of Our Lady, if it could be managed, or, if that is too soon to be ready, immediately after. Oh, with what happiness I shall press you to my heart! Dunya is all excitement at the joyful thought of seeing you. She said one day, in joke, that she would be ready to marry Pyotr Petrovich for that alone. She is an angel. She is not writing anything to you now, and has only told me to write that she has so much to tell you that she is not going to take up her pen now, for a few lines would tell you nothing, and it would only mean upsetting herself. She bids me send you her love and innumerable kisses. But although we shall be meeting so soon, perhaps I shall send you as much money as I can in a day or two. Now that everyone has heard that Dunya is to marry Pyotr Petrovich, my credit has suddenly improved, and I know that Afanasy Ivanovich will trust me now even to 75 rubles on the security of my pension, so that perhaps I shall be able to send you 25 or even 30 rubles. I would send you more, but I am uneasy about our travelling expenses, for though Pyotr Petrovich has been so kind as to undertake part of the expenses of the journey, that is to say, he has taken upon himself the conveyance of our bags and big trunk, which will be conveyed through some acquaintances of his, we must reckon upon some expenses on our arrival in Petersburg, where we can't be left without a cent, at least for the first few days. But we have calculated it all, Dunya and I, to the last penny, and we see that the journey will not cost very much. It is only 90 versts from us to the railway, and we have come to an agreement with a driver we know so as to be in readiness, and from there Dunya and I can travel quite comfortably third class. So that I may very likely be able to send to you not 25 but 30 rubles. But enough. I have covered 2 sheets already, and there is no space left for more. Our whole history! But so many events have happened. And now, my precious Rodya, I embrace you, and send you a mother's blessing till we meet. Love Dunya, your sister, Rodya. Love her as she loves you, and understand that she loves you beyond everything, more than herself. She is an angel, and you, Rodya, you are everything to us, our one hope, our one consolation. If only you are happy, we shall be happy. Do you still say your prayers, Rodya, and believe in the mercy of our Creator and our Redeemer? I am afraid in my heart that you may have been visited by the new spirit of infidelity that is abroad today. If it is so, I pray for you. Remember, dear boy, how in your childhood, when your father was living, you used to lisp your prayers at my knee, and how happy we all were in those days. Goodbye. Till we meet then, I embrace you warmly, warmly, with many kisses. Yours till death, Pulcheria Raskolnikov. Almost from the first, while he read the letter, Raskolnikov's face was wet with tears. But when he finished it, his face was pale and distorted, and a bitter, wrathful, and malignant smile was on his lips. He laid his head down on his threadbare, dirty pillow, and pondered a long time. His heart was beating violently, and his brain was in a turmoil. At last he felt cramped and stifled in the little yellow room that was like a cupboard or a box. His eyes and his mind craved for space. He took up his hat and went out, this time without dread of meeting anyone. He had forgotten his dread. He turned in the direction of the Vasilyevsky Ostrov, walking along Vasilyevsky Prospect as though hastening on some business. But he walked, as his habit was, without noticing his way, muttering and even speaking aloud to himself, to the astonishment of the passers-by. Many of them took him to be drunk.